Hello and welcome, friends, family, and of course, enemies alike, to episode 131 of Reading Cadence. I am your host, the displaced Wisconsinite, Phil Olson. Now, throughout the odd-numbered episodes of this season, we have been going through the casebook of Sherlock Holmes. And 2 weeks ago, we began the case entitled The Adventure of the Creeping Man. And Sherlock Holmes and Watson encounter a professor who is exhibiting rather erratic and unusual behaviors since a visit to Prague. And his assistant and his daughter have come, without the professor's knowledge, to Watson and Holmes's door to solicit their services to try to figure out what ails this man and why is he acting so peculiarly. And my theory is that the man is on drugs, and these are common symptoms of a man who is going through cases and series of withdrawals and is trying to hide his drug addiction from his assistant and daughter. But now, right now, we get to read through the conclusion of this case. Let us begin with The Adventure of the Creeping Man. Part 2, by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Monday morning found us on our way to the famous university town, an easy effort on the part of Holmes, who had no routes to pull up, but one which involved frantic planning and hurrying on my part, as my practice was by this time not inconsiderable. Holmes made no allusion to the case until after we had deposited our suitcases at the ancient hostel of which he had spoken. "I think, Watson, that we can catch the professor just before lunch. He lectures at 11, and should have an interval at home. What possible excuse have we for calling?" Holmes glanced at his notebook. "There was a period of excitement upon August 26th. We will assume that he is a little hazy as to what he does at such times. If we insist that we are therefore by appointment, I think he will hardly venture to contradict us. Have you the effrontery necessary to put it through?"
"We can but try."
"Excellent, Watson! Compound of the busy bee in excelsior! We can but try. The motto of the firm. A friendly native will surely guide us." Such a one on the back of a smart hansom swept us past a row of ancient colleges, and finally turning into a tree-lined drive, pulled up at the door of a charming house, girt round with lawns and covered with purple wistaria. Professor Presbury was certainly surrounded with every sign not only of comfort, but of luxury. Even as we pulled up, a grizzled head appeared at the front window, and we were aware of a pair of keen eyes from under shaggy brows, which surveyed us through large horn glasses. A moment later, we were actually in his sanctum, and the mysterious scientist, whose vagaries had brought us from London, was standing before us. There was certainly no sign of eccentricity either in his manner or appearance, for he was a portly, large-featured man, grave, tall and frock-coated, with the dignity of bearing which a lecturer needs. His eyes were his most remarkable feature, keen, observant, and clever to the verge of cunning. He looked at our cards.
"Pray, sit down, gentlemen. What can I do for you?"
Mr. Holmes smiled amiably.
"It was the question which I was about to put to you, Professor."
"To me, sir?"
"Possibly there is some mistake. I heard through a second person that Professor Presbury of Camford had need of my services."
"Oh, indeed!"
It seemed to me that there was a malicious sparkle in the intense gray eyes.
"You heard that, did you? May I ask the name of your informant?"
"I'm sorry, Professor, but the matter was rather confidential. If I've made a mistake, there's no harm done. I can only express my regret."
"Not at all. I should wish to go further into this matter. It interests me. Have you any scrap of writing? Any letter or telegram to bear out your assertion?
No, I have not.
I presume that you do not go so far as to assert that I summoned you.
I would rather answer no questions, said Holmes.
No, I dare say not, said the professor with asperity. However, that particular one can be answered very easily without your aid.
He walked across the room to the bell. Our London friend, Mr. Bennett, answered the call.
Come in, Mr. Bennett. These two gentlemen have come from London under the impression that they have been summoned. You handle all my correspondence. Have you a note of anything going to a person named Holmes?
No, sir, Bennett answered with a flush.
That is conclusive,
said the professor, glaring angrily at my companion.
Now, sir,
he leaned forward with his two hands upon the table.
It seems to me that your position is a very questionable one.
Holmes shrugged his shoulders.
I can only repeat that I am sorry that we have made a needless intrusion.
Hardly enough, Mr. Holmes!
The old man cried in a high screaming voice, with extraordinary malignancy upon his face. He got between us and the door as he spoke, and he shook his two hands at us with furious passion.
You can hardly get out of it so easily as that!
His face was convulsed, and he grinned and gibbered at us in his senseless rage. I am convinced that we should have had to fight our way out of the room if Mr. Bennett had not intervened.
My dear professor, he cried, consider your position. Consider the scandal at the university. Mr. Holmes is a well-known man. You cannot possibly treat him with such discourtesy.
Sulkily, our host, if I may call him so, cleared the path to the door. We were glad to find ourselves outside the house and in the quiet of the tree-lined drive. Holmes seemed greatly amused by the episode.
Our learned friend's nerves are somewhat out of order, said he. Perhaps our intrusion was a little crude, and yet we have gained that personal contact which I desired. But dear me, Watson, he is surely at our heels. The villain still pursues us.
There were sounds of running feet behind, but it was, to my relief, not the formidable professor, but his assistant who appeared round the curve of the drive. He came panting up to us.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Holmes. I wish to apologize.
My dear sir, there is no need. It is all in the way of professional experience.
I have never seen him in a more dangerous mood, but he grows more sinister. You can understand now why his daughter and I are alarmed. And yet, his mind is perfectly clear.
Too clear, said Holmes. That was my miscalculation.
It is evident that his memory is much more reliable than I had thought. By the way, can we, before we go, see the window of Miss Presbury's room?
Mr. Bennett pushed his way through some shrubs, and we had a view of the side of the house.
Is there the second on the left?
Dear me, it seems hardly accessible, and yet you will observe that there is a creeper below and a water pipe above, which gives some foothold.
I could not climb it myself, said Mr. Bennett.
Very likely. It would certainly be a dangerous exploit for any normal man.
There was one other thing which I wish to tell you, Mr. Holmes. I have the address of the man in London to whom the professor writes. He seems to have written this morning, and I got it from his blotting paper. It is an ignoble position for a trusted secretary. But what else can I do?
Holmes glanced at the paper and put it into his pocket.
Dorak. A curious name. Slavonic, I imagine. Well, it is an important link in the chain. We return to London this afternoon, Mr. Bennett. I see no good purpose to be served by our remaining. We cannot arrest the professor because he has done no crime. Nor can we place him under constraint, for he cannot be proved to be mad. No action is as yet possible.
Then what on earth are we to do?
A little patience, Mr. Bennett. Things will soon develop. Unless I am mistaken, next Tuesday may mark a crisis. Certainly, we shall be in Camford on that day. Meanwhile, the general position is undeniably unpleasant, and if Miss Presbury can prolong her visit...
That is easy.
Then, let her stay till we can assure her that all danger is past. Meanwhile, let him have his way and do not cross him. So long as he is in good humor, all is well.
There he is,
said Bennett in a startled whisper. Looking between the branches, we saw the tall, erect figure emerge from the hall door and look around him. He stood leaning forward, his hands swinging straight before him, his head turning from side to side. The secretary, with a last wave, slipped off among the trees, and we saw him presently rejoin his employer. The two entering the house together in what seemed to be animated and even excited conversation.
I expect the old gentleman has been putting two and two together, said Holmes as we walked hotelwards. He struck me as having a particularly clear and logical brain from the little I saw of him. Explosive, no doubt. But then, from his point of view, he has something to explode about if detectives are put on his track and he suspects his own household of doing it. I rather fancy that friend Bennett is in for an uncomfortable time.
Holmes stopped at a post office and sent off a telegram our way. The answer reached us in the evening, and he tossed it across to me.
Have visited the commercial road and seen Dorak. Suave person, bohemian, elderly, keeps large general store.
Mercer.
Mercer sent your time, said Holmes. He is my general utility man, who looks up routine business. It was important to know something of the man with whom our professor was so secretly corresponding. His nationality connects up with the Prague visit.
Thank goodness that something connects with something, said I. At present, we seem to be faced by a long series of inexplicable incidences with no bearing upon each other. For example, what possible connection can there be between an angry wolfhound and a visit to Bohemia, or either of them with a man crawling down a passage at night? As to your dates, that is the biggest mystification of all.
Holmes smiled and rubbed his hands. We were, as I may say, seated in the old sitting room of the ancient hotel, with a bottle of the famous vintage of which Holmes had spoken on the table between us.
Well, now let us take the dates first, said he, his fingertips together, and his manner as if he were addressing a class. This excellent young man's diary shows that there was trouble upon July 2nd, and from then onwards, it seems to have been at 9-day intervals, with, so far as I remember, only one exception. Thus, the last outbreak upon Friday was on September 3rd, which also falls into the series, as did August 26th, which preceded it. The thing is beyond coincidence.
I was forced to agree.
Let us then form the provisional theory that every 9 days, the professor takes some strong drug which has a passing but highly poisonous effect. His naturally violent nature is intensified by it. He learned to take this drug while he was in Prague, and is now supplied with it by a bohemian intermediary in London. This all hangs together, Watson.
But the dog, the face at the window,
the creeping man in the passage. Well, well, we have made a beginning. I should not expect any fresh developments until next Tuesday. In the meantime, we can only keep in touch with friend Bennett and enjoy the amenities of this charming town. In the morning, Mr. Bennett slipped around to bring us the latest report. As Holmes had imagined, times had not been easy with him. Without exactly accusing him of being responsible for our presence, the professor had been very rough and rude in speech, and evidently felt some strong grievance. This morning, he was quite himself again, however, and had delivered his usual brilliant lecture to a crowded class. "Apart from his queer fits," said Bennett, "he has actually more energy and vitality than I can ever remember, nor was his brain ever clearer. But it's not he, it's never the man whom we have known. I don't think you have anything to fear now for a week at least," Holmes answered. "I'm a busy man, and Dr. Watson has his patients to attend to. Let us agree that we meet here at this hour next Tuesday, and I shall be surprised if before we leave you again, we are not able to explain, even if we cannot perhaps put an end to, your troubles. Meanwhile, keep us posted in what occurs." I saw nothing of my friend for the next few days, but on the following Monday evening, I had a short note asking me to meet him next day at the train. From what he told me as we travelled up to Camford, all was well. The peace of the professor's house had been unruffled, and his own conduct perfectly normal. This also was the report which was given us by Mr. Bennett himself when he called upon us that evening at our old quarters in the Chequers. "He heard from his lodging correspondent today. There was a letter, and there was a small packet, each with the cross under the stamp, which he warned me not to touch them. There has been nothing else." "That may prove quite enough," said Holmes grimly. "Now, Mr. Bennett, we shall, I think, come to some conclusion tonight. If my deductions are correct, we should have an opportunity of bringing matters to a head. In order to do so, it is necessary to hold the professor under observation. I would suggest, therefore, that you remain awake and on the lookout. Should you hear him pass your door, do not interrupt him, but follow him as discreetly as you can. Dr. Watson and I will not be far off. By the way, where is the key of that little box of which you spoke?" "Upon his watch chain. I fancy our researches must lie in that direction. At the worst, the lock should not be very formidable. Have you any other able-bodied man on the premises?" "There's coachman, MacPhail." "Where does he sleep?" "Over the stables." "We might possibly want him. Well, we can do no more until we see how things develop. Goodbye, but I expect that we shall see you before the morning." It was nearly midnight before we took our station among some bushes, immediately opposite the hall door of the professor. It was a fine night, but chilly, and we were glad of our warm overcoats. There was a breeze, and the clouds were scudding across the sky, obscuring from time to time the half moon. It would have been a dismal vigil were it not for the expectation and excitement which carried us along, and the assurance of my comrade that we had probably reached the end of the strange sequence of events which had engaged our attention. "If the cycle of 9 days holds good, then we shall have the professor at his worst tonight," said Holmes. "The fact that these strange symptoms began after his visit to Prague, that he is in secret correspondence with a Bohemian dealer in London, who presumably represents someone in Prague, and that he received a packet from him this very day, all point in one direction. What he takes and why he takes it are still beyond our ken, but that it emanates in some way from Prague is clear enough. He takes it under definite directions, which regulate this ninth day system, which was the first point which attracted my attention. But his symptoms are most remarkable. Did you observe his knuckles?" I had to confess that I did not. thick and horny in a way which is quite new in my experience. Always look at the hands first, Watson. Then cuffs, trouser knees, and boots. Very curious knuckles, which can only be explained by the mode of progression observed by... Holmes paused, and suddenly clapped his hand to his forehead. Oh, Watson! Watson, what a fool I have been! It seems incredible, and yet it must be true. All points in one direction. How could I miss seeing the connection of ideas? Those knuckles! How could I have passed those knuckles? And the dog! And the ivy! It's surely time that I disappeared in that little farm of my dreams. Look out, Watson. Here he is. We shall have the chance of seeing for ourselves. The whole door had slowly opened, and against the lamplit background, we saw the tall figure of Professor Presbury. He was clad in his dressing gown, and as he stood outlined in the doorway, he was erect, but leaning forward with dangling arms, as when we saw him last. Now he stepped forward into the drive, and an extraordinary change came over him. He sank down in a crouching position, and moved along upon his hands and feet, skipping every now and then, as if he were overflowing with energy and vitality. He moved along the face of the house, and then round the corner. As he disappeared, Bennett slipped through the hall door and softly followed him. "Come, Watson, come!" cried Holmes, and we stole as softly as we could through the bushes until we had gained a spot whence we could see the other side of the house, which was bathed in the light of the half-moon. The professor was clearly visible, crouching at the foot of the ivy-covered wall. As we watched him, he suddenly began, with incredible agility, to ascend it. From branch to branch he sprang, sure of foot and firm of grasp, climbing apparently in mere joy at his own powers, with no definite object in view. With his dressing gown flapping on each side of him, he looked like some huge bat glued against the side of his own house, a great square dark patch upon the moonlit wall. Presently he tired of this amusement, and dropping from branch to branch, he squatted down into the old attitude and moved towards the stables, creeping along in the same strange way as before. The wolfhound was out now, barking furiously and more excited than ever when it actually caught sight of its master. It was straining on its chain and quivering with eagerness and rage. The professor squatted down very deliberately, just out of reach of the hound, and began to provoke it in every possible way. He took handfuls of pebbles from the drive and threw them in the dog's face, prodded him with a stick which he had picked up, flicked his hands about only a few inches from the gaping mouth, and endeavored in every way to increase the animal's fury, which was already beyond all control. In all our adventures, I do not know that I have ever seen a more strange sight than this impassive and still dignified figure crouching frog-like upon the ground and goading to a wilder exhibition of passion the maddened hound, which ramped and raged in front of him by all manner of ingenious and calculated cruelty. And then, in a moment, it happened. It was not the chain that broke, but it was the collar that slipped, for it had been made for a thick-necked Newfoundland. We heard the rattle of falling metal, and the next instant, dog and man were rolling on the ground together, the one roaring in rage, the other screaming in a strange, shrill falsetto of terror. It was a very narrow thing for the professor's life. The savage creature had him fairly by the throat. Its fangs had bitten deep, and he was senseless before we could reach them and drag the two apart. It might have been a dangerous task for us, but Bennett's voice and presence brought the great wolfhound instantly to reason. The uproar had brought the sleepy and astonished coachman from his room above the stables.
"I'm not surprised,"
said he, shaking his head.
I've seen him at it before. I knew the dog would get him sooner or later.
The hound was secured, and together we carried the professor up to his room, where Bennett, who had a medical degree, helped me to dress his torn throat. The sharp teeth had passed dangerously near the carotid artery, and the hemorrhage was serious. In half an hour, the danger was past. I had given the patient an injection of morphia, and he had sunk into deep sleep. Then, and only then, were we able to look at each other and to take stock of the situation. "I think a first-class surgeon should see him," said I.
"For God's sakes, no!" cried Bennett. "At present, the scoundrel's confined to our own household. It is safe with us. If it gets beyond these walls, it will never stop. Consider his position at the university, his European reputation, the feelings of his daughter."
"Quite so," said Holmes. "I think it may be quite possible to keep the matter to ourselves, and also to prevent its recurrence, now that we have a free hand. The key from the watch train, Mr. Bennett. Macphail will guard the patient and let us know if there's any change. Let us see what we can find in the professor's mysterious box." There was not much, but there was enough. An empty phial, another nearly full, a hypodermic syringe, several letters in a crabbed foreign hand. The marks on the envelopes showed that they were those which had disturbed the routine of the secretary, and each was dated from the Commercial Road and signed A. Doric. They were mere invoices to say that a fresh bottle was being sent to Professor Presbury, or receipts to acknowledge money. There was one other envelope, however, in a more educated hand, and bearing the Austrian stamp with the postmark of Prague.
"Here we have our material,"
cried Holmes as he tore out the enclosure. "Honored colleague," it ran, "since your esteemed visit, I have thought much of your case, and though in your circumstances there are some special reasons for the treatment, I would nonetheless enjoin caution, as my results have shown that it is not without danger of a kind. It is possible that the serum of anthropoid would have been better. I have, as I explained to you, used black-faced lungor, because a specimen was accessible. Lungor is, of course, a crawler and a climber, while anthropoid walks erect and is in all ways nearer. I beg you to take every possible precaution that there be no premature revelation of the process. I have one other client in England, and Doric is my agent for both. Weekly reports will oblige. Yours with high esteem, H. Lowenstein."
Lowenstein!
The name brought back to me the memory of some snippet from a newspaper which spoke of an obscure scientist who is striving in some unknown way for the secret of rejuvenescence and the elixir of life. Lowenstein of Prague. Lowenstein with the wondrous strength-giving serum, tabooed by the profession because he refused to reveal its source. In a few words, I said what I remembered. Bennett had taken a manual of zoology from the shelves.
"Lungor," he read. "The great black-faced monkey of the Himalayan slopes, biggest and most human of climbing monkeys. Many details are added. Well, thanks to you, Mr. Holmes, it is very clear that we have traced the evil to its source."
"The real source," said Holmes, "lies, of course, in that untimely love affair which gave our impetuous professor the idea that he could only gain his wish by turning himself into a younger man. When one tries to rise above nature, one is liable to fall below it. The highest type of man may revert to the animal if he leaves the straight road of destiny." He sat musing for a little with the phial in his hand, looking at the clear liquid within. "When I have written to this man and told him that I hold him criminally responsible for the poisons which he circulates, we will have no more trouble, but it may recur. Others may find a better way. There is danger there. A very real danger to humanity. Consider, Watson, that the material, the sensual, the worldly, would all prolong their worthless lives. The spiritual would not avoid the call to something higher. It would be the survival of the least fit. What sort of cesspool may not our poor world become?
Suddenly, the dreamer disappeared, and Holmes, the man of action, sprang from his chair.
I think there is nothing more to be said, Mr. Bennett. The various incidents will now fit themselves easily into the general scheme. The dog, of course, was aware of the change far more quickly than you. His smell would ensure that. It was the monkey, not the professor, whom Roy attacked, just as it was the monkey who teased Roy. Climbing was a joy to the creature, and it was a mere chance, I take it, that the pastime brought him to the young lady's window. There is an early train to town, Watson, but I think we shall just have time for a cup of tea at the Checkers before we catch it. End of The Adventure of the Creeping Man, Part 2, by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, okay, so you telling me it was drugs that Professor Presbury was on? Interesting. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, I did not read ahead last week when I made an errant proposal that this man was experimenting with some artificial substances known to affect the body. No. But I digress, because honestly, this ending kind of felt a little bit like the end of a Twilight Zone episode, you know what I'm saying? So, like, just imagine for me, if you will, the scene cuts away to Professor Presbury at the end, and he's just sitting in a corner, huddled underneath a thick blanket, shivering, with a ice pack on his head, going through an intense bout of withdrawal from all the drugs that he was on. And then in cuts Rod Serling sadly holding a cigarette in his fingers, and he says something like, "As Sherlock Holmes said, when one tries to rise above nature, one is liable to fall below it. The highest type of man may revert to the animal if he leaves the straight road of destiny." Such was the case for our dear friend, Professor Presbury, who took a slight detour into the Twilight Zone. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you know? And, I mean, Twilight Zone does an excellent job of revealing mankind's stupidity and also their short-sightedness. And in this case of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes mystery, it was revealing the short-sightedness of Professor Presbury giving into a very common fallacy that many elderly people experience and fail to fully express because they don't want it to be true. In the fact, and it isn't true, the fact that as you get older and as you're able to contribute less to society that you're a part of, your value and your sense of worth is also less and decreased and declining. And maybe, sometimes the thought goes through somebody's head, maybe my loved ones, friends, and family are just waiting for me to die because I'm too much of a burden on them. Like, I'm costing them too much money for them to host me in a nursing home or to provide home health care for me or whatever the case may be. And let me tell you, like, that's something that is nothing, there's nothing farther from the truth in those statements. Because, first of all, you have, you know, familial relationships with other people. You've invested so many decades of your life to workplaces, to your families, to just friendships and other forms of relationships. There's no way somebody's going to just be like, "Eh, you haven't been able to prove it to me for the past 5 years, so maybe you should just, you know, die, you know, because you're not really worth it." And I know there's a lot of European nations that are okay with, like, with, like, euthanasia, and I'm not even just picking on them. Like, I know there's a lot of places in America as well where, like, euthanasia is like, an idea that a lot of older people are considering, or maybe even some of the younger generation who doesn't see their value is just like, maybe they'd be... It'd be more humane for them to just, you know, gently and kindly pass away. And it's just like, I was just with a bunch of people of the older generation, not quite that deep in age, but like, just like the wisdom that they were able to communicate to me and like pass on to me. I mean, I was just sitting there soaking in. Like, there was literally nothing that I could contribute to the conversations that we were having that would have been of any value to them. And just like, they've experienced so much of life. They know how to encounter something. And, you know, just like thinking about, you know, like as a younger person going through certain stages of life, you know, in the realm of like home ownership or in the realm of marriage or in the realm of raising children or in the difficulties of the workplace environment, you look at those different facets and stages of life, and it's nothing that somebody else hasn't gone through before, that you can glean some guidance and good counsel for how you deal with it in your life. And so I just don't buy that fallacy, but I know it's so easy to fall into. Like, you're not going to be able to contribute after you stop working, or, you know, you catch a really bad illness or disease. Like, you're somehow lesser in the eyes of those who love you. I just wanted to push back against that ideology. And I think Professor Presbury was starting to feel that. I mean, after all, he's been a man of great intellect in academia for decades and been able to teach over and over again some really complex subjects and break it down in really easy, understandable, chewable terms for his students to understand. And then he perhaps was feeling some loss of his mental alacrity and just some of his independence. He was feeling that it was stripped away from him, and he was just going after to try to, like, get a high again, you know, like, get reinvigorated. He was getting weary. He was getting tired. And there's no way to escape that fatigue. Like, it's going to happen to us all. You know, all humanity is cursed in this way, and so it's just kind of like, you gotta take it. And it's important to continue to surround yourself with loved ones during those times as well, and know that they communicate their love to you through so many ways, and you've done more than your share to contribute and pour back into their life. Because the ironic thing was, Professor Presbury had communicated so much of his wisdom and knowledge to the younger generation as someone his age should be doing. And he was trying to prolong that, or he was trying to do something else, and he was losing himself in the process. He was losing touch with reality, and if I'm being honest, a little creepy dating somebody who's like, I don't know, 60 years his junior, you know, trying to gain back that spark of romance, like, way past his prime. So, you lose yourself when you try to press against the natural order of things. And there are some things that you can't cheat code your way out of. Bottom line, older generation, incredible value. Don't stop being the older generation and being you, because incredibly value. Now, awkward transition, as next week we are going to be reading a book about a bunch of younger people who are trying to figure out what the American dream looks like for them. Nick Carraway finally is able to meet the mysterious and lonely Jay Gatsby. And so he's trying to glean some more information off of this guy and figure out, as I'm trying to figure out, what makes Gatsby so great. So come in next week to hear about The Great Gatsby, Chapter 4. But sadly, I must say thank you all so much for listening to another episode of Reading Cadence. But as they say in show business, for now, that's all he wrote.